From Leave It to Beaver, the 1950s, 1960s sitcom about family life, what was considered sort of the norm of family life, introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about family structure, which has come a long way, baby, you might say, from the natural family model of a nuclear family and Leave It to Beaver, and now we have all sorts of issues of LGBT agendas and same-sex households and surrogacy. And to talk about these issues, we want to turn to Katie Faust, who grew up in a same-sex household with her lesbian mother and is now a Christian mother of four, married to a church pastor, and is a founder of the organization Them Before Us, a child rights organization which advocates for the rights of children to grow up with their biological mother and father. Well, Katie, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
Well, first of all, just talk about your life. And you grew up in had a divorce among your mother and father. And how do how does your biography affect your stance on these issues, and how have your beliefs evolved and so forth?
Yeah. Well, my parents were married until I was 10 and then divorced. And then my father dated and remarried. And my mother fell in love with another woman. And they've been together ever since. So that is most of what I've known in terms of my mom's life. Thankfully, I was raised by both my mom and dad before and after the divorce. So I'm certainly not the story of a fatherless girl raised by two women. But I am definitely a woman who loves her mother and loved her mother's lesbian partner, and knows that I still needed my father, that those two women could not replace my dad, and thankfully they didn't try. And so I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I became a Christian late in high school, married my husband right after college, and honestly stayed out of the political fray until about 10 years ago when we were debating same-sex marriage here in Washington State. That was right after President Obama evolved on the topic of marriage to the point where, you know, he ran in 2008 supporting traditional marriage, and then around 2012 he evolved on the topic. And what I heard right after that was two things coming from mainstream media especially. Number one was that bigotry alone was the motivation for supporting natural marriage, right? It's only hatred of gays that would lead you to a traditional natural marriage position. And that's just flat out libel. I mean, really, because I love my mother. I love her partner. I don't consider her partner to be my mother, but I do consider her partner to be my friend. And I hope that when they think about the people who love them, that I am at the very, very top of the list. They've always been a part of my life. They continue to be a part of my life and my children's lives. There's just no animosity at all between us. So this idea that you hated gays or you were phobic or whatever, if you believed in man-woman marriage, was just, I mean, it was a tool to keep people quiet, and it worked. The other thing that I heard them saying is kids don't care if they have two moms or two dads. And that was the big push leading up to Obergefell, the Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage for the entire country. And I had been working with kids for a couple decades at that point, and I took major offense to this claim that children don't care if they have two moms or two dads, because what that means functionally is kids don't care if they have lost their mom or dad. Anytime you're looking at the home of two women and a child, you're looking at the picture of a fatherless child. Anytime you're looking at the picture of a child that's growing up with two dads, that is a home where they have lost their mother. And so sometimes when there are tragic circumstances, sometimes the child is going to lose their mother or father. But right now we are in the place with Obergefell and the passage of same-sex marriage, and now in addition, all of these reproductive technologies, where we are incentivizing and manufacturing motherless and fatherless children in the name of progress. And so that's an injustice, right? When a child loses their mother or father to tragedy, we mourn. But these days, in the name of progress, in the name of promoting modern families, we are actually insisting that children lose their mother or father, and we're calling it good. Now, the problem with that is kids are harmed when they lose their mother or father, whether it's through death, divorce, abandonment, even if they're subsequently adopted, or through these third-party reproductive processes and technologies. And so that's why I got into this whole battle, was because they were lying about children. They are literally insisting that children lose something they have a natural right to, which is a relationship with their mother or father, so that adults can live as they please. And that is finally the point where I said, I'm going to wade into the fray and start speaking up on these issues, because you are harming children with your lives.
Well, did you have any particular background dealing with children? Were you involved in, say, like, did you have any sort of like counseling position or so forth? Did that also provide any sort of insight?
No, well, not in terms of my education background, but I did work at the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world before I had kids. And then I became a mom, so I've got the experience of, you know, mothering my own children. And then I became an adoptive mom, and understand the loss, but also the redemptive aspects of adoption in a very personal kind of context. And then I have the ability, well, not the ability, but the gift of having grown up around a lot of LGBT people. And so I feel very comfortable in that world, which means that I've been able to build quite a coalition of people who identify as single or married or gay or straight, who are a part of what is now becoming a global children's rights movement to defend children's rights to their mother and father. So I think that it's more of a life experience that has led me to this place in terms of working with kids in youth ministry and understanding the pain and the loss that they experience when they're not being raised by their mother and father, understanding that adoption is a child-centric institution, not a means for adults to get kids, understanding that we can empathize and support our adult friends who are going through all of these challenges, whether it's infertility or same-sex attraction or struggling marriages, but still insist that they respect the rights of children. I think that it's probably personal experience that makes that more than educational experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you say you, with connections with your mother, you had a lot of sort of relationships in sort of the LGBT community. Did that affect in any way how your views evolved on in terms of issues of child rearing? Did you notice anything there in say other households or with other people?
Well, I didn't have a whole lot of contact with kids who had gay and lesbian parents when I was young, but I certainly grew up, like most kids of the 80s and 90s, with tons of kids who were children of divorce. And so we do emphasize and scrutinize divorce and no-fault divorce as a massive harm in the lives of children. In fact, when we talk about divorce, we say, you know, no-fault divorce was the original redefinition of marriage, right? That was the first time that we took what used to be the most child-friendly institution the world has ever known, heterosexual marriage, and we began to transform it into a vehicle of adult fulfillment. Because what we said about no-fault divorce is, it used to be that this was an institution centered around the well-being of children, but then what no-fault divorce communicated was that you could exit the marriage when you decided that you were not happy in the marriage, right? So now the marriage exists for your happiness. And then gays and lesbians looked at that and said, well, if marriage is just about making adults happy, then being married to somebody of the same sex makes me happy. And so no-fault divorce inflicted massive casualties, especially in the 80s and 90s, And now we are just riding that train into the next station, which is the redefinition of marriage into a genderless institution as well. So I think that what I observed as a child, but then especially what I observed as an adult working with kids, was that if you mess with a kid's childhood, you know, their family structure, the stability that they need in marriage, you know, the food, the emotional food they receive from their mother's love and their father's love, if you're going to mess with that, you will leave them malnourished and unstable for the rest of their life unless they receive serious healing.
Well, okay, so that brings up, you know, this phrase you often hear, you know, love makes a family. That, you know, as long as, you know, people are committed to each other, it doesn't really matter whether a person has a mom or a dad. Well, is that really true, or does biology in terms of, you know, a child's biological connections to a mother and father, does that make a difference? I mean, what are the things that come up there versus, say, like parents versus step-parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me just give you, if you don't mind, let me just give your listeners a quick tour of the book, so you kind of understand where we're coming from and all the different topics that we address. And then we're going to come back to this love makes a family question. We came out with a book last year. It's got 10 chapters. It's called Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. Chapter one is all about why children have a right to their mother and father. And it is an unbending, unflinching, natural right, just like a child's right to life. And so the same reasoning and processes that lead you to believe that children have a right to life also validate that children have a right to their mother and father. The second chapter is called Biology Matters, and it's that biology in the parent-child relationship is critical to children for two main reasons. Number one, biological parents statistically, and obviously there are exceptions, but the general rule is that biological parents are the safest, most connected to, most protective of, and most invested in their children. And so people will often say, well, kids don't need biological parents. They just need to be safe and loved. And I'll say, well, congratulations. You believe that children should be raised by their biological parents. Because any other adult, statistically, again, there's exceptions. There's exceptional step-parents in children's lives. I know them. I'm grateful for them. But overall, the presence of an unrelated adult, whether it's a stepmother, a stepfather, a cohabiting boyfriend, a cohabiting girlfriend, diminishes child outcomes. Any two will not do. Sociologists on the left and the right agree that the things that advantage children the most is being raised in a married, low-conflict home of their own biological parents. So that is the rule. And so if you are serious about children being safe and loved, you will insist on them being raised by their biological parents whenever possible. The other reason why biology matters is because those two adults that made the baby grant something to the child that they crave, and that is their biological identity. Children long to know, who am I, right? Teenagers are always asking that question, who am I? It's very hard to answer that question when you don't know, whose am I? This is the main reason why adoptions have shifted from being closed adoptions where these kids didn't have any identifying information or contact with their first family to today when we have 95% of adoptions being open. They have some degree of connection and identifying information or relationship with their first family because that biological identity matters to kids. So our third chapter is called Gender Matters, and this is all about the complementary ways that men and women parent children. I'm sure your audience probably knows a lot about this already, so I'll just summarize and say men cannot mother and women cannot father. And kids crave motherly love, they crave paternal love, and they benefit developmentally having a male and female parent. So biology matters and gender matters. And so we take those two realities and we then take a look at all these other marriage and family issues that we're facing today. The first one being, what is the definition of marriage? And when you look at it from the perspective of children's right to their own mother and father, that they developmentally benefit from the presence of their mother and father, that they crave the love of their mother and father, that they seek out the biological identity that they get from their mother and father, you see that marriage suddenly becomes a matter of justice for children. That the definition of marriage, defining marriage as man and woman, is actually one of the greatest areas of justice when it comes to advocating for children, because if we get marriage right, you often get all of childhood right. And when you redefine marriage into an institution that excludes a man or a woman, you transform parenthood into a relationship that excludes mother or father, and that always inflicts loss on children. Chapter 5, we talk about divorce and how the movement towards no-fault divorce has devastated children, that it harms them physically, mentally, emotionally, and relationally. Chapter 6, we talk about same-sex parents. We spend the first half of the chapter debunking the studies that show that there's no difference between kids raised by same-sex couples and kids raised by opposite-sex couples. And then we just fill the rest of the chapter with about 30 stories of kids that grew up with two moms or two dads talking about their desperate hunger for their missing father or their hunger for their missing mother. Chapter 7, we talk about sperm and egg donation, donation in air quotes, because nobody's donating. This is a for-profit industry where everybody is buying or selling the genetic materials needed to make a child. And we talk about the identity struggles these kids have, the feelings of commodification because they were purchased at birth. We talk about how eugenics plays a role in what we call big fertility, the industry of baby making. And we talk about how these kids desperately long to know their biological father or mother and their dozens or hundreds of half-siblings that are spread across the globe or maybe across the street. Chapter 8, we talk about surrogacy, how surrogacy is never child-friendly. Surrogacy is not about babies. Surrogacy is about on-demand designer babies shipped worldwide. We talk about adoption in Chapter 9, how adoption, even though it begins with loss for children, it is actually a child-centric institution, whereas big fertility is an adult-centric marketplace. And finally, Chapter 10, we just talk about our children's rights movement. So as you can see, we take this principle that children have a right to their mother and father. And once you get that right, you get all these other questions about marriage and family correct as well.
Yeah, that's a lot. Those are all very interesting issues. I mean, thinking of surrogacy, I've heard before that actually there's a strange phenomenon that sometimes people will actually maybe not even know it, but they'll actually be attracted to their unknown siblings. I mean, you get questions of sort of like incest arising, that there's this case in Germany, I guess, about a decade ago or 15 years ago, where a man and a woman fell in love, and they later found out that, you know, they were actually half-siblings because they were both born through surrogacy, and some people have described that there's actually some sort of natural tendency that people will sort of gravitate towards people who are related to them if they don't know that, and will actually have an attraction towards each other. It then became a case at the European Court of Human Rights of whether they could, you know, stay married or not because they were indeed biologically related to each other.
Yeah, that's called genetic sexual attraction. It's been observed among adoptees or reported among adoptees for quite a while. There actually was just a film going around Instagram a couple of days ago, somebody reading about how these two people who had been in a sexual dating romantic relationship for 6 years both took a 23andMe test and realized that they were full siblings, both had been adopted at birth. That is probably the number one concern of children created through sperm and egg donation, is that they are accidentally dating somebody that they're related to. This is a very real problem, because if you look at sperm donors, for example, sperm donors can have tens to hundreds of children if they're quote-unquote donating a couple times a week for many years. And then if the problem doesn't end with the child who has been donated because they are concerned about dating their half-siblings. But one woman that shared her story on our website said, you know, I probably have 50 half-siblings that live somewhere in my area, but I didn't know that I was conceived through sperm donation. I'm very fortunate to have not married a genetic relative, but now my children have hundreds of first cousins that they don't know, and that's because many of their parents probably didn't know that they were conceived through sperm donation. And so we actually have, you know, there's one of our donor-conceived advocates at Them Before Us, his name is Nicholas Eisel. He was conceived through sperm donation, and he said, this is not the way the gene pool is supposed to work. You're not supposed to have one biological parent that is fertilizing 200 females in his lifetime. That's not how our species works. And it's actually pretty dangerous to the gene pool. So we are really messing with the foundations of not just the individual child, but also all of society as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And so you mentioned how are step parents different from biological parents? I mean, you indicated that it's really healthiest for children to be with biological parents. How do step parents react or act in contrast to biological parents?
Yeah. So thankfully, I'm going to first say, as I always do, I know heroic step parents who are stepping in to fill the gap left by a negligent biological parent, right? They said, I am going to get into this relationship not just because of this child's mother or this child's father, but because I'm going to commit myself to this child. And very often they are able to go a long way in mending a major loss for that young son or young daughter. However, step-parents do not statistically improve outcomes for kids. Children bear just about the same when raised by a lone mother as they do when raised by mother and her new husband or her boyfriend. And so we don't see a major advantage when children's parents remarry, unless that child's parent remarries their own biological parent. There was a study done a couple of years ago in the UK that studied lone mothers, evaluated how their children fared, which was not great, compared them to children raised by their married biological mother and father from birth, contrasted them with moms who married unrelated men, and those children didn't fare as well. But if they married their child's biological father, they found that these kids were able to catch up and get back to a near level of where their peers raised exclusively by their married mother and father were. Now, that's fantastic when that can happen. But we have this fantasy, right, that you'll even hear it happening in the language of researchers or sociologists or family scholars. They'll just talk about married parents. But the reality is that you don't just want married parents. You don't just want married heterosexual parents. That doesn't advantage children the way that married biological parents advantage children. And so one of the main statistics that you can look at, because back to what you said, well, love makes a family. But there's the emotional and sexual attraction, the sexual goals and aims of the adults, right? If they have love in their life, right, if they're emotionally and romantically fulfilled, then there's a family, right? That's all you need. Now, if that was the case, then kids who are raised by their mother and her cohabiting boyfriend would be doing great. Because mom's happy, right? She's sexually fulfilled. She's romantically fulfilled. You know, there's two incomes in the house. There's a man and a woman, so it should be just fine. Well, if you want to see whether or not love makes a family in those situations, you can Google the words mother's boyfriend. And what you'll see is pages and pages, like thousands of pages, of the most horrific, graphic child sexual abuse, neglect, and homicide that you'll find anywhere on the internet. It turns out that an unrelated cohabiting man, especially one that is left to care for the child alone, is statistically the most dangerous person in a child's life. And so we have this fantasy, right, that love makes a family. If the adults are happy, the kids will be happy. That's a lie. We know what it takes kids to thrive, and it is not just sexually fulfilled adults in their home. It is being raised by their own married biological mother and father, and any other household structure only diminishes child outcomes.
Well, talking about love makes a family, and these couples, are same-sex couples really stable for raising a child? I mean, these affections and so forth, do they really last, or how does that look?
Well, gays and lesbians have not had the ability to marry for very long. And so we don't necessarily have as much data as we need to answer that conclusively in the sense of how do married same-sex couples do. But we know that overall there are probably 2.5 times higher breakup rates among lesbians than among heterosexual married couples. It's maybe 50% higher for gay men. So lesbians tend to break up much more quickly, even though they tend to be more highly exclusive. Gay men can have quite long-term relationships, but by their own admission, they are open relationships, right? So there's much lower rates of exclusivity among gay households and among lesbian couples, much higher rates of breakup. And so neither of these are good factors when it comes to including children in the household. That's actually one of the biggest problems with the research around same-sex parenting. Most of it has been focused, but it's very hard to compare apples to apples in terms of comparing lesbian couples who have raised kids throughout the child's life, because very few of those lesbian couples actually stay together for the entirety of the child's life. So you really are comparing apples and oranges, because men and women are different, right? The differences that we see in gay couples and lesbian couples are really just male-female differences on steroids. And it's like you can actually look at same-sex couples, like two lesbians or two gay men, and you can actually see that male and female differences actually exist, and they're the most pronounced when you're looking at an exclusively male or an exclusively female household.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And thinking of surrogacy, you know, sometimes you might hear the claim that, surrogacy is pro-life. I mean, it allows people to, raise a family, experience the joys of child raising. Is that true? Are things like in vitro fertilization pro-life?
Yeah. So let's just do some quick definition of terms. IVF, in vitro fertilization, is making babies in the laboratory. And all kinds of people make babies in laboratories. Single adults, heterosexual, sweet Christian heterosexual couples do it. Two women do it. Two men do it. People that intend to use a surrogate do it. People that intend to implant the baby into their own mother's womb do it. So IVF is simply the process of making children in glass, right, where you're combining egg and sperm together in glass. Maybe the egg of the woman that's going to raise the child, maybe not. Maybe the sperm of the man who's going to raise the child, maybe not. So IVF is just the process of making babies outside the woman's body. IVF is a product. It is going to be necessary in surrogacy. So surrogacy is renting the womb of another woman to gestate the child. Maybe the child will go home with a heterosexual couple that they're genetically related to. Maybe the child is going to go home with a single man who has a criminal background, right? We don't know, because the big fertility industry, unlike the adoption world, doesn't do any screening or background checks on the adults that procure children through these technologies. Third-party reproduction means you're using a third party to reproduce. That might be the genetic material of another man via sperm donation. It might be the genetic material of a woman through egg donation. And then it might be the womb of a third party. So at Them Before Us, we oppose all third-party reproduction, because all third-party reproduction insists that a child lose a relationship with their mother or father to fit into some adult's desire for a certain household. And our big rule at Them Before Us is adults should not make kids a sacrifice for them. Rather, it should be adults who sacrifice for kids, not kids who sacrifice for adults. So surrogacy is problematic. Well, first of all, IVF is problematic. That is, if you value human life. Only about 7% of children created in laboratories, children created through IVF, will be born alive. Only 7%. Over 90% of these children will be discarded, deemed non-viable and discarded, not graded high enough and be discarded. The ones that do make the grade very often are going to be deemed surplus embryos. They won't be immediately transferred to the mother's womb or the surrogate's womb, and they will be cryogenically frozen and very often never emerge. Right now we've got about 1 million embryos on ice in this country. Many of them have been functionally abandoned. We don't know who their parents are. They stopped paying the storage fee for the freezer storage fee. So this is not a pro-life technology. And then if they do emerge from the freezer, sometimes they don't survive the thaw. And if they survive the thaw, they don't necessarily survive to implant in the mother's womb. And if they do implant in the mother's womb and three of these babies, take or implant, and then the commissioning parents decide that three is too many, then very often you will selectively reduce the babies in the womb. That's just this, that's code for abortion. Selectively reduce to determine, to get down to the right amount, or selectively reduce if there seems to be some kind of developmental marker that looks like it's not advantageous or desired. And so abortion serves as both quality control and quantity control in big fertility arrangements, especially surrogacy. So IVF is not a child-friendly technology. Even if you are using the gamete, even if the child goes home with the biological mother and the biological father, and that baby is born alive, you're still looking at a very, very slim percentage of the babies that were created in the laboratory, right? Most of the babies didn't survive the process. And then when you're looking at surrogacy, you know, it's a very challenging topic because we pro-lifers, we conservatives, we love babies. I love babies. And we think, well, surrogacy is about babies, but it's not. Surrogacy is about on-demand designer babies shipped worldwide. And I'll just give you a quick cheat sheet about what surrogacy really does. Surrogacy splices what should be one woman, mother, into three purchasable and optional women. So the first mother is the genetic mother, the one that contributes the genetic material, the egg donor. The second one is the birth mother, the person with whom the baby will form a deep, abiding, critical relationship for the first 9.5 months of the baby's life. And the third woman is the social mother, the woman who will raise the child and be that feminine presence in the baby's life as they grow up. And surrogacy allows you to say, which of these women do you need? Which one do you need to purchase? Which one can you do without? So maybe you just need a birth mother, and then the genetic mother is going to use her own genetic material, and then she's going to raise the baby, right? So you're going to need one out of those three. But maybe you're a single man, and you need the genetic mother and the birth mother, and then you plan to cut the social mother out of the child's life altogether. So anytime you've got these three women, genetic mother, birth mother, and social mother, if all three of those women are not found in the same woman, you're insisting that a child lose something to you, and that is an injustice. Now, we know that there are some situations where a child will lose their birth mother and their genetic mother through adoption. And in those situations, those tragic situations, we seek to mend the child's loss through adoption, but we don't pretend like that the child did not have a loss, and we don't manufacture that child's loss. So surrogacy is always the insistence that a child lose one to three of their mothers so an adult can have something that they want.
And in that process, I've heard that maybe I was reading at your site or somewhere else that children even have a desire, they even for just a birth mother. I mean, a child, they, as you're indicating, you know, a child might be biologically related to their mother who raises them, but that mother and the couple has used another woman for the process of birth. But even there, the child will feel a sense of loss of not knowing the woman who gave them birth.
Have, obviously, oceans of adopted children who grew up in loving heterosexual homes who still are very curious or oftentimes go on protracted searches to find their birth mother. We have fewer because it's not, our species is not one that lends itself to mother loss in infancy, right? We don't have a lot of studies and a lot of stories about children who are disconnected from their birth mother on day one because children used to die or they would lose their birth mother. Adoptees will then hopefully have that situation sought to be mended through adoption. But this idea of losing just your birth mother but not your genetic mother, that has been only possible in the last couple of decades. So we don't yet have studies on these kids. We don't yet have a lot of stories of kids created through these means. Why? Because we are experimenting with the foundations of our species. It's new because it's bad, right? It's new because it's not something that would ever be able to happen naturally. So, I mean, a lot of people will say, well, you don't have studies about that. And I'm like, right, because this is not how human babies are made. And this is not something that is going to be optimal for their development because it can only happen wildly outside of the constructs of our design.
Yeah, and you're discussing this process. I mean, that figure, only 7% of embryos, reach the birth stage. I mean, all the others, they, you know, get lost in some freezer or somewhere. They're just thrown away, or you have this selective reduction abortions and so forth. You know, it strikes me that, some 20 years ago at the beginning of the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, you know, there's this big debate over embryonic stem cell research and how, you know, that involves destruction of human beings, fertilized embryos. And yet here you're talking about procedures that are just, you know, ongoing daily matter that are just, throwing away, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or, you know, I don't know, like a million or so embryos or something. Has there been any developing movement to say, hey, look, this is just an outrage against the dignity of human life and this needs to stop?
Unfortunately, there has not been much of an outcry. Part of that is because pro-lifers are not aware in a lot of ways as to how much the baby making industry violates the right to life that children have. Like, we're very aware of how the abortion industry violates children's right to life, but we are unaware of how much the big fertility baby making industry violates children's right to life. So part of it is just people have not been told. The other part is when adults want something, they will justify it in any way that they can. And so what you have is a lot of conservatives and a lot of Christians and a lot of pro-lifers that want to use IVF because they long to have a child or they're dealing with infertility. And so you talk about how many of these technologies are harmful to kids. And now you're not stepping on the – you're outside of the realm where they're used to fighting and operating, which is against abortion. And now you've stepped into something that they really want. Right? They long to be mothers, and many of them would be incredible mothers, right? Or many of these men know that they would desperately like to have a child, or their wife is desperate for a child, and maybe they've been told IVF is the only way that they can make that happen. And, I mean, I've had people stand up and walk out of apologetics conferences where I'm speaking when I talk about IVF because they've said to me, get out of my way. I'm going to have a baby no matter what. And it's a beautiful drive to want to be a parent. The problem is that we cannot violate the rights of children. We cannot make children sacrifice for us in our pursuit of becoming a parent. We cannot violate children's right to life, any child's right to life, on our quest to becoming a parent. We cannot violate any child's right to their mother or father in our quest to become a parent. And so I think that the conservative pro-life world has gotten fairly comfortable saying, I'm sorry you're facing an unplanned pregnancy. Just because you're scared or sad or concerned does not justify violating a child's right to life. Now we have to say, I'm sorry that you're dealing with infertility, but just because you desperately want a baby does not justify you violating a child's right to life. So all adults, so that's the problem and the blessing of advocating for children's rights, right? Being on the them before us train, is we insist that all adults, single, married, gay and straight, fertile and infertile, sacrifice for children. In this world of respecting children's right to life and right to their mother and father, no adult gets a pass. Every adult has to do hard things to protect his kids.
Yeah, and I mean, this really, these processes you're describing, it just really is, of course, Aldous Huxley's or Brave New World scenario here. It's really frightening. Has there ever been much talk of, you know, this whole idea of surrogacy and, you know, designer baby? Does that then harm, sort of cheapen the value of life and means that you inflate the value of human life so then you don't have enough focus on adopting kids who already exist and need an adoption?
Yeah, well, it's like who exists for who? In adoption, when adoption is done properly, the adults exist for the child, right? If adoption is done properly, every child that needs adult parents, every child that needs a loving family is going to be placed with a loving family. But not every adult that wants a kid is going to get one. Not every adult should be handed an unrelated child, right? Adoptive parents like me, and probably like a lot of your listeners, had to go justifiably had to undergo screenings and vettings and background checks and home studies and references, because social workers aren't fools. They know that placing children with unrelated adults is risky. And so adoption is an institution centered around the well-being of children, and adults need to conform to that. Reproductive technologies and big fertility, in essence, says the kid exists for me. The goal is to get a baby to the adults no matter the cost, no matter the cost to how many children have to die in the process, regardless of the cost to the child that is born, if they can't have a relationship with their mother or father. And these technologies, I mean, you can see it even in the conversation that Dave Rubin, who's a darling among people on the right these days, he and his partner created two surrogate babies, and he talks about the process of choosing the egg donor, and he likens it to dating apps, like where you're selecting the different features that you want, just like a girl that you're going to hook up with. And so, yes, like you're treating these children as something that is owed to you, even if it costs some babies their life, even if it costs them a relationship with their mother and father, and you are designing them. You are picking their mother and father out of a catalog, and that is why so many of these kids created through third-party reproductions feel like products. Like they will say, we talk about this in detail in Chapter 7 of our book, they talk about how they were designed and purchased, how they don't feel like they were even treated like a human. They felt like they were treated like a commodity because they were treated like a commodity. That is ultimately completely different from the way that all of the best practices of adoption are set up. And further, in adoption, you can never directly pay the birth parents for the child. It is a violation of international adoption standards. But that's exactly what is going on in sperm donation, egg donation, and surrogacy. You are paying the birth family, you are paying the biological parents to take their child. And that is why these processes, these technologies are often indistinguishable from child trafficking, because it actually violates many of the child trafficking statutes that we've got in place across the world.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that surrogacy and these other processes, IVF and all, it's not regulated. I mean, I've heard like real horror stories. Like there's one case, some guy apparently was just like handing out vials of his own semen from like the back of his pickup truck or something, and not really caring. I mean, discuss some of those cases. I mean, what are the things that are possible here?
Well, once you're making a baby in a laboratory, right, almost anything is possible. I mean, right now Dave Rubin has two children who are both from the same egg donor, so they're half siblings in the sense that they're genetically related to their mother, but each of them were conceived via their distinct father's sperm. So they're half siblings. Each of them is going to have a stepfather and a biological father in the home. They're being gestated into different women, right? So are they half siblings? Like, are they twins? Well, not in the traditional sense, but I guess in the egg donor sense, they are. I mean, like, there's a million ways you can mix and match sperm, egg, and womb and come home with a baby or more. There's all kinds of services that have popped up. You know, you've got guys who tour the country or tour internationally, providing free sperm, and often do so the natural way in terms of inseminating women the old-fashioned way, or just, you know, jacking off right outside the house and handing them a vial. You know, sperm clinics don't love that because they get a lot of business through systems of saying, well, we're screening the sperm. So it's a crap show, honestly. Like, it's anything goes. It's the wild west of baby making. And all of these systems, all of these processes, all of these technologies, ultimately, there's one party that bears the cost of it, and it is the child. Maybe the adults are all happy. Maybe the woman is happy that she's got the guy who rolls up in his van and hands her a fresh vial of sperm. Maybe all the adults consent to this. Maybe the surrogate consents to it. The child doesn't consent. The child does not consent to losing a relationship with their biological mother or father, or being severed from their birth mother, the only human that they know, the only person they have a relationship with at the moment of birth, to be handed over to people that are totally foreign to them.
Yeah, one of the stories you have recounting his personal experience at your website, Them Before Us, talked about how, you know, he didn't really came to understand that he was the product of, you know, some guy who just pleasured himself at a fertility clinic and, you know, then given his semen to his mother, you know, that really didn't please him. I've seen on a documentary on PBS I saw about dealing with the life of some teenager kid who was growing up in a lesbian household, and he had been also the lesbian mother had been inseminated by some guy out in California whom they later interviewed. He was living out in like his trailer out on the beach in California, and they went to a fertility clinic and they showed these so-called masturbatoriums where, you know, an individual will go in there and there's, you know, the walls are just laid in with all sorts of pornographic images, and a man can then just pleasure himself that way and to extrude his semen to give it to some lesbian such. And, you know, in the case of Dave Rubin, I've often heard too that you know, people like David Rubin, they will intentionally try to divide up, as you say, the mother because they want to break any bond of the child to the mother. So they'll intentionally say, okay, we'll get the egg from one woman, we'll place it into another woman who will give birth, and then we'll have, you know, any sort of breastfeeding or whatever will be done by yet a third woman. So you want to do everything that you possibly can to just erase any contact with that biological parent, with that mother. It's really a bizarre world here, and it's some of the other accounts on your website, they talk about, for example, a guy, you know, if they have a father saying he comes out as transgendered, he now wants to, as they say, transition to become a woman. You know, they talk about they have a really disturbing relationship there. So that's another facet that, you know, kids don't really find any of this behavior to be appropriate. They don't feel good about being in such situations.
Yeah, and, you know, all of the scenarios that we are talking about here, whether it is the same-sex attracted adult who wants to form a family with their partner, whether it is the couple in the struggling marriage, you know, where dad decides that he's actually in love with the secretary and he wants to run off with her, the situation of an infertile heterosexual couple that desperately wants a baby and dad's sperm count, you know, is struggling and so they want to seek out a donor, or it's the parent that struggles with gender dysphoria or transgender feelings who then wants to transition to become somebody of the opposite sex. All of these situations are actually very major struggles for the adults involved. I mean, these are not small things that adults are dealing with. The problem is when the adult desire to run off with the secretary or to get a sperm donor to deal with their infertility or to form a family around their sexual attractions rather than the child's rights to their mother and father or to give in to their diagnosis of gender dysphoria and transition to become female. All of these desires, when they are prioritized above children's right to a mother and father, harms the kids. So I'm not going to minimize or diminish the heartache or the pain or the struggle that these adults experience. Like when I'm not doing children's rights advocacy, I am in my husband's office counseling people who struggle with everything I just mentioned and being incredibly empathetic about the kind of challenges that they're experiencing right now. The thing is, no amount of adult struggle or longing or loss ever justifies forcing a child to accept hardship so you can live as you please. It's an injustice. We adults, we are made to do the hard things. We are supposed to sacrifice and accommodate and be understanding for our children. But when you prioritize adult desire, like transitioning to become a woman or running off with a secretary or dealing with infertility by seeking out a third party, what you're really saying is, this burden is too heavy for me. Here, kid, you take it instead. And then you saddle your child with lifelong loss. That is the line that you cannot cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in your case and others, what sort of reception do individuals face if they come forward and say, hey, look, you know, as been noted on your website at Them Before Us, you know, this whole idea of, you know, people have written about, you know, my dad wanted to, you know, now has this desire to become a woman. He's got gender dysphoria. And that was just devastating for me. It was like, you know, my father dying. I mean, in a sense, you know, the personality I once knew is now disappearing. Or, you know, someone say, you know, criticizing, you know, being the product of some person who just simply pleasured himself at a fertility clinic and gave his semen to my lesbian mom. I mean, that's just something I don't want to deal with. Or, you know, just whatever, the whole lifestyle issue of gay lifestyle or whatever. Do these individuals coming forward and expressing disappointment, you know, anger, regret, do they face backlash for doing this?
Yes. Yep, 100%. That's why, while I verify the identity of people that are on our website, I often encourage them to share their story under a pseudonym, because these people are, it costs, you know, we have a preface in our book called Expensive Stories. It is so expensive for kids to tell the truth about how devastated they were when their father transitioned to become a woman, or how much they longed to have a daddy every single day of their life, even though they were well-loved by two moms. Even the kids of divorce who are like successful 50-year-old lawyers still will not talk about their parents' divorce and write about it under their own name, because they are literally still trying to keep both their mom and dad happy at Christmas. I mean, like, if you tell the truth about how your parents' choices harmed you for life, you are actually threatening the relationships that you love the most. And many of these kids have been trying to keep it together and hold on to a relationship with their parent who oftentimes prioritized selfishness above what their kid needed. And so the reason why you don't hear these stories, we've got about 120 in our book of kids that were raised in modern families, so that you can get a really accurate picture of what mother loss and father loss cost children for life. But the reason why you don't hear these stories is because kids can lose a relationship with their parents. They can lose friends. I mean, the worst thing in the world for kids that are raised by two lesbians is to be accused of being anti-gay. Like, many of them really love their mom or their two moms, if their two moms are still together. But many of them are still close to their biological lesbian mom and understand that they'll be ostracized from the family, you know, if they share this honestly. So that's one thing that we decided was really important, was for people to understand the raw, honest stories of kids who lived through all of these modern families, so that you have no illusions. So that when somebody says love like a family, you can be like, nope, it doesn't. Modern family. I walked into a Target display a couple of years ago, you know, with a little girl mannequin that said love made this family, and then with two moms behind her. And I'm like, nope, loss made that family. The child had to lose her father to make that family. And so we just need to start identifying and calling out these cultural lies, because kids pay the price when we don't call it out.
Well, thinking of these battles over various LGBT agendas and like marriage and so forth, you know, are these battles now lost, or how should people like you move forward to you know, correct these wrongs and these misunderstandings? I mean, how are social conservatives doing, for example, in the Republican Party or institutions like the Conservative Political Action Conference?
They're not doing well. Number one, they're compromising, right? For the first time ever last year, you had a majority of Republicans who supported gay marriage. Number two, a lot of them just aren't talking about it anymore. Like, we're not bringing up marriage and family anymore because we think that we've lost, you know, with the Supreme Court decision with Obergefell. But now you've got things like the laughably named Respect for Marriage Act, which is supposed to be brought up in the Senate in the next week or two. They need 10 Republicans to be on board. They might have that. And all of these Republicans can do in terms of thinking about why they should oppose the Respect for Marriage Act is concerns over religious liberty. You know, oh no, could churches lose their 501c3 status? Yeah, they could. But the main issue is, you can no longer say that children should be raised by a mother and father, because now in this world of modern family, that's a discriminatory statement. If you do not stand up and fight these legislative battles, what you're saying is it doesn't really matter if kids have moms or dads, which is probably, other than they don't have a right to life, the greatest lie you could ever tell about children and the greatest harm to their future thriving. And so Republicans and conservatives have got to get this straight fast. Whatever the Supreme Court decides, whatever the Senate decides to legislate, you will never legislate away a child's longing for their mother and father. Your laws and your culture will simply either respect it or victimize children as a result. And I'm stunned, right? I am stunned that very few in the conservative world or the Republican Party seem to get this straight. I am concerned that they are going to compromise on the topic of marriage when they write the 2024 party platform, because people are just like, well, no big deal. But you know what? All of these priorities about responsible citizenry and small government and low taxes, you don't get any of that without big marriage, and not just any kind of marriage, not open non-monogamy or polygamous marriage or same-sex marriage. The only way that you are going to produce the kind of citizens that will permit a small government is children raised in marriages of their own mother and father. And so you can ignore this. You can go la, 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 fingers in the ears. That's fine. You'll never get any of your legislative priorities unless you get back to the point where you're prioritizing the married mother and father home. Anything else is going to wreck the next generation.
Well, you're living out in Seattle, and we're talking earlier, chatting a bit. There's the news there of, the issue of a pending teacher strike, and in Florida as well, we have all these flipping of school boards for conservatives with candidates endorsed by the Florida Republican governor there, Ron DeSantis. What role do school boards and the education system play here? I mean, what should people be on the lookout for there? I mean, what sort of battles should people fight there?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, that the children belong to parents, they don't belong to schools, right? All of these issues ultimately don't have to do with what curriculum or what library books or whatever. The question ultimately is, to whom do children belong? And the answer of the Democrats is they belong to the state. We decide your child's medical care. We decide whether or not they get the vaccine. We decide when they go to school. We decide what they learn at school. And if children belong to the state, yeah, that's true. But they don't. Children belong to their parents, right? And that is why we have seen this surge in parental rights activism, justifiably so, because what we are seeing is the state encroaching on this pre-political relationship between parents and children. And that's great. We're getting a lot of justifiable action and emphasis on parental rights to direct children's upbringing and to direct their medical care. What nobody is talking about is children's rights to their parents, right? These are natural rights, and they are complementary. If parents have a right to the child that they gave birth to, and they don't want just any baby in the nursery when they leave the hospital, they want that baby. Children also have a right to go home from the hospital with their own parents, because those are statistically the adults who are most likely to be connected to, invested in, and protective of them, the ones that are going to grant them their biological identity, maximize their child development, and make good decisions about their medical care and their educational opportunities. And so we've got to, I'm so grateful we're focusing on the rights of parents to their children in these educational battles and medical battles. We have also got to look at this from the child's perspective and start defending those kids.
Well, thinking of this summer, we had, speaking of the Supreme Court and sort of comparing and contrasting with the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage, we had, of course, the overturning finally of Roe v. Wade. What could your movement here, this family rights movement, children rights movement, learn from the pro-life movement in going forward?
There's so many parallels. First of all, I would say that what the pro-life world did so successfully, well, they did a lot of things. One thing was they said, we don't care what the civil law says. We don't care that the civil law does not recognize children's right to life. We're going to argue like Martin Luther King Jr. did on natural rights, right? Children have a natural right, a right that is self-evident through natural law, that children have a right to life. And regardless of what your politics say, regardless of what civil law says, we are going to advocate for and argue for children's natural right to life. That is also the approach that we need to take in the marriage and family battle. Regardless of whether or not the state says that you can have parent one and parent two on a birth certificate, regardless of whether or not the state says, oh, we can't talk about mothers and fathers because it'll make some kids feel bad, regardless of whether or not the state says that marriage can be two men, two women, three men, three women, whatever, children have a natural right to their own mother and father, and we are going to defend that right whether or not it is recognized in law. The next thing that the pro-life world did so well is they did two things. They worked on changing culture and they worked on changing laws, right? So we had pro-lifers that were creating pregnancy resource centers, right? And they were filling their supporters with good answers to good questions about things like my body, my choice, and what about rape and incest? I mean, there's not a pro-lifer I know that can't refute those within seconds, right? And so they worked to transform culture, but they also tried to make these legal gains, tried to figure out where's the chink in the armor of Roe versus Wade and work towards overturning it. We need to do the same thing in the marriage and family debate, right? We need to change the culture so that people know how to respond to these common objections about marriage and family, like, oh, you know, well, there's abusive biological parents out there too. Oh, are you saying that, you know, children should be raised, should stay in an orphanage rather than be raised by gay parents? Oh, are you saying, you know, if you support traditional marriage, that's the same thing as like supporting miscegenation laws, you know, bans against interracial marriage. So like, we can respond to these kinds of things. We respond to all of that in our book. Like, you have to be ready to change the culture by bringing the best information to them. But we also need courageous lawyers who are going to be able to say, where can we start to eat away at the unjust definition of marriage that we passed in 2015? The other thing that the pro-life world did so well is they empathized with struggling adults, right? They empathized with the woman in the unplanned pregnancy, right? They offered her support, but they said, the line you can't cross is violating this child's right to life. We need to take that same approach into the marriage and family debate and empathize with people in struggling marriage and empathize with women that are dealing with infertility and empathize with our gay and lesbian friends who would be incredible mothers or incredible fathers. We just say the line you can't cross is insisting that a child lose their mother or father just because you're struggling. So I actually feel like if anti-abortion work was Children's Rights 1.0, marriage and family and children's rights to their mother and father is children's rights 2.0. These two go together, and we have got to figure out children's rights 2.0 right now, because it's only going to get darker and it's only going to get worse, both in terms of legal changes, technological changes, and cultural changes, right? All three of those things are moving away from a child's natural right to their mother and father and towards these increasingly broken households.
All right. Well, excellent. That's been very stimulating, very interesting conversation there. For our listeners out there, you've heard here another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we've been talking to Katie Faust, the founder of the organization Them Before Us, which also has a similar, same name book out, documenting their work protecting the rights of children to their mother and father. Well, Katie Faust, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.